Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for April 15th, 2019. This is David Corey along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. We have more news and information of interest for veterans and their families, but first I'd like to acknowledge two of our sponsors for our show, Joyce and Joe Schifferoli, whose financial contribution helps make us make this show possible for the benefit of veterans and their families across the country. Also, I wish to remind everyone that this is a call-in show. It welcomes your views, your comments, and your questions. Call us anytime during the show, 1-888-627-6008. Again, toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. Good evening, Richard.
Hey there, David. As we reported earlier in February, big news for Navy veterans who served on ships off the coast of Vietnam. I know they've been waiting for this news for a very, very, very long time. We've represented a number of these veterans, and unfortunately their claims were unable to go forward because they weren't considered service-connected. But veterans who served on ships off the coast of Vietnam during the Vietnam War, the Federal Appeals Court decided on Tuesday, January 29th, that the Department of Veteran Affairs cannot, I say cannot, deny disability benefits to these thousands of veterans. And from what I understand, it's about 90,000 veterans who may be in this situation. And these veterans claim exposure to cancer-causing chemical defoilants simply because those that served in the waters off the country's coastline and not inland. The decision in the case of Procopio versus Wilkie marks a big victory for so-called blue water Navy veterans who have fought the VA for years over the denials of their Agent Orange disability compensation claim. VA officials have asserted that the existing scientific evidence doesn't justify the presumption of toxic exposure for the group, and strongly opposed legislative effort to overturn their decision. But the 9-2 decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Court on January 29th overturned past court opinions which had supported the VA. The decision basically held that Congress never intended to exclude service members in the seas around Vietnam when they awarded presumptive benefits for certain illnesses related to Agent Orange exposure. The court said, in part, these statutes cast no doubt on our conclusion that by using the formal term Republic of Vietnam, Congress unambiguously referred, consistent with uniform international law, to both its land mass and 12 nautical mile territorial sea. So as we've said in the past, for those veterans who were in combat and on the soil of Vietnam, when you had one foot in, then you were eligible for these Agent Orange presumptions. Well, now, you Blue Water Navy veterans, you're going to enjoy the same presumption. I'm going to talk more about that later, but I know, David, you've got something to talk about regarding John Wells.
Right, and it is interesting, just from a cost of war perspective, that here we are, five decades after the Vietnam War, and veterans from that war are still fighting for disability compensation, and the issues are increasing in number, as shown by the Agent Orange issues, which have been a focus for decades and continuously are bringing new issues. And the Blue Water Navy issue is one of those, referring specifically to sailors and other service members who were on Navy ships off the coast of Vietnam and that believed that their disabilities were caused by exposure to Agent Orange, which was a defoliant sprayed in Vietnam. On some of our prior shows, including as recently as our February 11, 2019 show, we've had as our guest Commander John Wells, Navy veteran, an attorney and the executive director of a nonprofit organization called Military Veterans Advocacy. John Wells is, a lawyer, and he's one of the premier veteran advocates in the nation. I just wanted to relay this evening some information, Rick, to supplement what you were saying about the Blue Water Navy issue, because John Wells and his organization, Military Veterans Advocacy, has played a huge role, probably the most visible role of any veterans group on this issue. And I follow what Commander Wells posts on his Military Veterans Advocacy Facebook page, as well as the website for Military Veterans Advocacy. And just a couple days ago, he posted a report on his trip this past week to Washington, D.C., where he had a chance to meet with VA Secretary Robert L. Wilkie. Commander Wells reported, and I quote from his report, "Although we were told that there would be a number of staff personnel there, it was a one-on-one meeting. The Secretary was very cordial. He promised the VA would move forward with implementing Procopio," meaning the Procopio versus Wilkie court decision. And he, referring to the Secretary, also agreed that they will use the baseline as the start of the territorial sea. The limit will be 12 miles out from the baseline. And Commander Wells provided the Secretary with excerpts from the 1958 Convention on the Territorial Seas and the United Nations Convention for the Law of the Seas. And those materials were delivered to the Secretary the previous day, and he had obviously read those materials before Commander Wells met with him. Commander Wells also reported that the VA said they will allow cases to be reopened based on the Procopio decision without providing new and material evidence, which is important. And he noted that the VA has said there will not be an appeal or petition for certiorari, which basically means that the VA is not going to contest the decision by the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which was a 9-2 decision in favor of the Navy veterans. Commander Wells' trip report also indicated that he recommended that the Secretary work with the Secretary of the Navy to provide annual training opportunities for quartermasters and other rates experience in plotting, and offered to bring an expert to Washington to train any group assigned to that task. The Secretary was receptive to those ideas, and it said he'd already talked to the Secretary of the Navy that they would need assistance from the Navy. In Commander Wells' opinion, he anticipates that the VA will move forward first on disability claims involving ships that were in harbors. It's easiest since to prove which ships were in harbors because the ship deck logs always note when a ship enters or leaves the harbor. Commander Wells suggested that they look for entries indicating the ship left or entered the territorial seas, and he pointed out to the fact that if radar ranges to land were less than 24,300 yards, or the ship was participating in Operation Market Time, that they were within the territorial seas. And finally, pointed out that the maximum effective range of guns on destroyers, destroyer escorts, and light cruisers conducting naval gunfire support was prima facie evidence that a ship was within the territorial seas, and the Secretary of the VA seemed receptive to all this information. On another very important issue, separate from the Navy Blue Water Agent Orange issue, is that involving Agent Orange and other toxins on the island of Guam. Commander Wells discussed with the Secretary a Guam bill in the House right now. It's H.R. 1713, and the Secretary apparently was aware of that legislation already. The Secretary said he's going to visit Guam at the end of May of this year, and that the issue of dioxin exposure is high on the list of his discussion points. The Secretary and Commander Wells also discussed other military veteran advocacy initiatives, including an issue, Rick, that you and I have discussed on previous shows, and that is the issue of the open-air burn pits and the toxic exposure to veterans who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as they also discussed funding issues. The Secretary had previously told Commander Wells that neither he nor the President wanted to take money away from one veteran program to pay for another one. And Commander Wells reminded him that his group agrees with that position, but that it was contrary to what are called the PAYGO limitations facing Congress right now. Secretary apparently shared with Commander Wells some funding ideas that he said were not ready for public discussion. That's kind of an interesting note. You know, what's going on in not in the public hearings, but in private discussions. It's always interesting how that may pan out. But we'll have to see. Commander Wells' report from his trip to Washington also mentioned that a Senate bill on the Blue Water Navy, which is S-1195, was initiated by Senator Gillibrand from New York along with 31 co-sponsors this past Thursday. And the House is working on language in a similar bill, H.R. 299. Commander Wells also indicated that he will do a supplemental report soon to discuss the legislation in more detail. And he also mentioned, you know, because in the context of the Procopio decision, which was a big win for the Blue Water Navy veterans, he also pointed out, this is Commander Wells, that, and I quote from his report, he says, "The thing to remember is that we really do not need a bill at this point," meaning referring to legislation in Congress, "but it would be nice to have. But what we do not want is to pass language which would limit the effect of the Procopio decision." In his opinion, the Senate bill is exactly what we want. He's not so confident about the House counterpart to that. Commander Wells will be providing in the near future more analysis of those and potential pitfalls of that legislation. Meanwhile, he wanted to also concentrate on a bill, H.R. 1713, the Kilpatrick Central Pacific Island Relief Act. They have up to 24 co-sponsors on that so far, which he thinks is a pretty good start. I'd like to remind our listeners that Commander Wells, his organization's website is militaryveteransadvocacy.org. That's militaryveteransadvocacy.org. They're also a presence on Facebook, and they'd appreciate any support, including financial support. But also, he says prayers and other support would be appreciated. Commander Wells has really done extraordinary work and has shown the impact that one individual can make. Of course, he's working with a team in his organization, but I know he does a lot, and a lot of trips to Washington, D.C., meet with members of Congress, and as he did this past week with the Secretary of the VA. So he's really working hard, and we appreciate his efforts. We look forward to continuing to keep up with the work of Commander Wells, Military Veterans Advocacy, as well as other groups and the legislation pending in Congress on these and other veteran issues. Over to you, Richard.
Yeah, before we go into anything else, you know, David, you know, this is great that they're doing that, but this is long time coming. I mean, there are so many Navy Blue Water veterans who are dead today as a result of Agent Orange, who aren't going to benefit from this new legislation. And Congress has dragged their heels once again all across America while our veterans die and don't get the compensation that they're entitled to. You know, one of the things I'm curious about is if there is a veteran who is deceased, and he was a Blue Water veteran, and it can be shown that that he died of what would be an Agent Orange disease, let's say ischemic heart disease, can the widow now step up to the plate and file a claim on his behalf and get some a pension for herself? I would think that that would be something that she'd be entitled to.
So I would agree with you, and it's definitely something that needs to be pursued.
You know, I mean, if this is going to open up a whole can of stuff. And, you know, David, I've been, you know, every day I talk to one or two of the representatives down in St. Pete, and this is all great news with Mr. Wells and Wilkie and all this kind of stuff. But I can tell you, as of 3 days ago, the people in St. Pete, according to my contact, have no clue as to how they're going to be handling the Blue Water compensation claim. They're getting no direction from Washington, D.C., absolutely none. They're sitting out there on an island waiting for something to happen, and they don't know what they're going to do with it. So while, you know, Wells is going up there to D.C. and we're having all these nice, you know, little, you know, Tea Party conversations, how is that affecting our veterans on the ground? Once again, we're talking about boots on the ground with our veterans. How is this new legislation going to be implemented and help our veterans? I don't, you know, I'm not so confident that we're going to start seeing the floodgates of helping these Blue Water Navy vets. You know, you and I both know we've had a couple of claims over the years that we've had to let go because, you know, we couldn't prove it. The guy was in Blue Water and he did not have an avenue to an Agent Orange presumption condition, even though he was suffering from ischemic heart disease. So he, you know, we had to let his case go. And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, maybe I can try to find his file and call him up again. Is he aware of this new legislation?
Well, it's the Procopio decision. Procopio decision isn't legislation. It's a court decision that I think Commander Wells deserves and other veteran groups deserve credit because part of their strategy has been not just meeting with the secretary, but he's been involved in litigation. And if it wasn't for the litigation in which the Procopio decision was issued in favor of these veterans, they'd have nothing because Congress hasn't passed any legislation. And the legislation that's pending now is, I think, if whatever passes, as Commander Wells mentioned, they have to make sure that Congress doesn't try an end run at the VA's behest to scale back the effects of the Procopio decision. So I think what John Wells has done and other veteran groups that have fought the VA up to the federal circuit level that they deserve a lot of credit. Otherwise they'd be getting nothing. And you know, we're not even halfway through April, and actually the time hasn't even run yet where, you know, for the VA to have decided not to continue to fight the Procopio decision. They could have, but the good news is, as Commander Wells reported, is that the secretary acknowledged that they were not going to, the VA was not going to continue to appeal it or specifically file a writ for certiorari with the Supreme Court.
I mean, so, could you imagine, though, David, if the VA decided to fight it? I mean, the uproar amongst the veterans?
Well, the VA has been pretty stubborn in fighting the Blue Water veterans for many years, and when we saw that just in the last in the last 6 months, where you know, legislation made it through the House but then stalled in the Senate, and the VA leadership did a 180 change of direction from supporting it to opposing it, saying that there really wasn't enough science behind making the link that ships, you know, many, many miles offshore were sufficiently affected by Agent Orange. Now, Commander Wells and his group have assembled lots of evidence to show that there is sufficient connection. But you're right, there is going to be a further delay. Nothing in the VA world happens quickly, unless the VA is trying to reduce someone's rating and take their money. That's about the only thing that happens at a prompt speed. But yeah, so there's going to be a time and just further delay in implementing it, and then no doubt there's going to be other issues that have to be hammered out, as far as proving exactly which ships were in harbors or how close to shore they were, those sorts of things. So
it's going to be interesting, to say the least. So, but in some other news from Washington, this past Thursday, Senator Johnny Isakson from Georgia, of the State Committee on Veterans Affairs, called on the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs to do everything in its power to fundamentally change the service they deliver for the better during a committee hearing on the ongoing implementation of the VA Mission Act. VA Mission Act landmark legislation authored by Isaacson and signed into law in 2018 improves the way the VA delivers health care by streamlining the department's community care programs to remove bureaucratic obstacles to care in the community and ensure veterans receive efficient, timely, and quality care. He said, everybody wants us to be successful. We want the VA to fundamentally change the service they deliver for the better, reliability for the better, participation for the better. So timely care to a veteran is the primary thing we're providing, and we provide a mechanism to do that as efficiently as possible to avoid a lot of the problems we've had in the past. The Mission Act is an amazing piece of legislation. It's comprehensive. It took a lot of testimony, and those of you who came to all of our meetings will tell you we got the input of the veteran, we got the input of the professional, we got the input of the VA, and we have a bill that I think has the opportunity to be a mainstream positive from here on out. He continued, we have no option but for it to be that. I will tell you this, we cannot fail. The senator emphasized the committee is eager to assist the VA throughout the implementation process to ensure the reformed community care program is a success from day one. The VA is expected to implement the new streamlined Veterans Community Care Program by June 6, 2019. And Isaacson questioned by Dr. Richard Stone, the executive in charge at the Veterans Health Administration, on whether the VA would be able to meet this deadline. Dr. Stone explained that the software transition for the Veterans Community Care Program is complex and some problems may need correcting. But the VA is confident that they will deliver care on June 6th and will continue to improve each day. The senator thanked Stone for his candor and pledged to assist as needed in reaching that goal and correcting problems as they arise. Wednesday's hearing included testimony from two panels of witnesses from the VA, the U.S. Government Accountability Office, Disabled American Veterans, and Milliman, an actuarial firm that developed expenditure estimates for the VA Mission Act. David, what else can you tell us about the Mission Act?
Well, it was an important major piece of legislation that was passed last year, and it was another in a series of congressional actions that you could trace back to the root problem of the VA healthcare scandals, starting with Phoenix back in about 2014 or so. But the VA Mission Act of 2018, as you mentioned, it's supposed to improve and streamline the VA's community care program. By community care, meaning when can veterans receive medical care in the local community, meaning non-VA facilities, in lieu of VA treatment. That's part of it. And it's supposed to improve the VA healthcare delivery itself. And also, in another important issue, is to expand the so-called caregiver program to veterans of all generations. The caregiver program is a very complicated program in which the VA provides compensation and other benefits to help family members who serve as caregivers for severely disabled veterans. It's an issue we've talked about some prior shows, and has received a lot of negative attention, a very unhappy feedback from many veterans and their family members over this. But the VA Mission Act, and the word mission in this is actually an acronym. You know, anyone in the military or the government is used to these acronyms, and mission in the Mission Act title refers to the following: maintaining internal systems and strengthening integrated outside networks. That's Mission Act of 2018. And specifically, it's supposed to consolidate what were seven different VA community care programs into one streamlined program. It's supposed to remove the prior arbitrary 30-day or 40-mile barrier to veterans' care in the community, which meant that for a veteran previously to get care in the local community, they either had to be waiting 30 days or be before more than 30 days for a VA appointment or live more than 40 miles away. So it's supposed to remove those arbitrary ones and It's also supposed to authorize access to walk-in community clinics for enrolled veterans who had previously used VA healthcare services in the last 2 years. It's supposed to authorize local provider agreements to remove bureaucratic red tape and to meet veterans' needs for the care in the community. In other words, it's just supposed to make it easier for veterans to get that care in a timely manner. And it's also supposed to establish standards for timely payment, because the community providers aren't going to want to participate if they're not getting reimbursed by the VA in a timely manner. And the bill, obviously, a lot of it turns on money, so this Mission Act provides $5.2 billion for the Veterans Choice Fund, among other things. So we'll see how it pans out. As you mentioned, Richard, the goal is that the VA will roll out this new community care program to go live on June 6th of this year, which is less than 2 months away. So we'll see what actually happens. It's clear from what Senator Isaacson from Georgia and also Democratic Senator John Tester, who is the senior Democratic member of the Senate Veterans Committee, that they are both paying a lot of attention to this, since they were both co-authors of the VA Mission Act last year. So they both expressed concern about this. They want to improve the care for veterans, and they're going to be watching the implementation and see how it actually works. As Senator Tester said in a press release last week, and I quote, "My concern is that the VA is outsourcing its responsibility to ensure veterans receive timely and high-quality care. When the VA sends veterans into the community without first knowing if that care can be provided in a timely manner or a high quality, it is outsourcing its responsibility. In writing the VA Mission Act, we specifically required the VA to ensure that community providers could meet the same access standards the department established for itself. But now we find that the VA is establishing one set of rules for itself and no rules for the private sector." So it could be a matter, you know, the old saying, you know, you're going from one thing and going to a worse situation. And that's apparently Senator Tester's concern. And at the hearing last week, Senator Tester did remind the VA that while it outsources the care to the community, it can't outsource its responsibility for that veteran's well-being. So, as I said, it'll be interesting to see how the VA implements this over the next few months and even longer over the next year. So, Rick, moving on to the VA benefits side of the house, I know you've gained a lot of insights about the current state of VA appeals and the processing of those appeals, particularly for cases that are still at the regional office level, whether with the old decision review officers under the so-called legacy system or under the new appeals rules under the so-called higher level review process. What insights can you offer to veterans whose disability claims are on appeals?
Well, first I'll tell them to hang on and be patient, because this new system, as they call it now, the AMA system, which took over for the RAMP program, is not exactly turning out to be what the VA thought it was going to be. I know in the St. Pete regional office, for instance, they brought in about 90 new employees to help with the new system. They've got about four currently handling the legacy cases, which were under the old system, those were the cases that the lawyers or representatives were seeking hearings for. And so those cases are being handled separately. Unfortunately, those four people are handling probably 80% of the work now in the St. Pete office. And all those new employees that were brought in basically have nothing to do right now. And, of course, I can't name names, but I've talked to a couple of people down there, and the VA doesn't really know what they're going to do and how they're going to fix it, because they've got a lot of people down there now who don't really, you know, they're not really having to work that hard. And they're hoping that in time the system will finally pick up and these new cases will start coming in and St. Pete is going to be the headquarters for the new system of cases. So they're hoping that that's what's going to happen. In the meantime, the old cases are still taking most of the manpower. The other thing that veterans should know is that whether you're in Florida or whether you're in another state, it's very possible that your case, because of this new system, has been what they call brokered out to another jurisdiction that doesn't have as much work. So, for instance, I have cases that I filed here in St. Pete, or here in Florida, that would be venued in St. Pete, that are sitting in Boise, Idaho, Portland, Oregon, Newark, New Jersey. And the thing about this is that unless you stay on top of the VA, and if you're a veteran and you don't have someone who's helping you, and I dare say these DAVs and the VSOs as representatives really aren't going to be doing this type of work for the veteran. And by that I mean you got to stay on top of the VA. You got to be able to access somebody there who can actually tell you where your case is. Because you could be sitting for months, maybe years, thinking that your case is sitting in St. Pete when actually it's been sitting out in Boise, Idaho. And you would have no idea that it's out there. And the only reason that I'm aware of my clients whose cases are out there is because I do have a contact within the VA and we work closely together. And every once in a while, I'll ask them, you know, can you check on John Doe? You know, I'm wondering where that case is. And all of a sudden he goes, oh, my God, this your case is sitting up in Maine. Mr. Doe is sitting up in Maine. And, you know, what, then this service officer, or the VA rep down there in St. Pete, tries to bring that case back to St. Pete so he can then work on it. But you can see the whole process here. It's archaic. You know, we're supposed to be moving into a new system that's supposed to be helping these veterans, streamlining compensation cases so that we can expedite them faster, not wait the usual 2 to 4 years that these veterans have been waiting, when in reality, that's what's going to continue to happen. And I get that directly from the people that I talk to down in St. Pete. They don't think the new system is any better off than the old system. It's not. Actually, some of them say they think it's worse. You know, you've got to be able to, and David, you and I have talked about this in the past, and you might want to talk about it tonight if we have time, is, you know, the three different avenues, the supplemental claim form, you know, the higher review form. I mean, these are all new reviews, new options, new paths that the veteran must now take that is different from the way it used to be. And if you're not familiar with it and you're not sure, how to work your case through the system, you're going to get lost. And what's going to happen is you're going to get a quick denial, you're going to get kicked back onto your lap, and unless you have some guidance, professional guidance, you're not going to know what to do. I know, David, you know, if you want, why don't you give us a quick overview of those three paths?
Sure. Well, what will happen under this new appeals modernization program, and this goes back to legislation that was passed by Congress in over a year and a half ago in August of 2017, it basically creates three new, what they call review lanes, when an initial claim has been adjudicated. And by that I mean a veteran files a disability claim, it's either been denied or maybe it's been granted in part, maybe with a rating that's lower than what the veteran considers fair. This new system creates three different lanes. You can choose one of these three, and if you're unhappy with the outcome of that, then you can continue in one of the other lanes. But the three lanes, like you mentioned, Richard, there's supplemental claim lane, that's the first. There's the higher level review lane, that's the second. And the third is the appeal directly to the Board of Veterans Appeals. Now, when I say first, second, and third, you don't have to follow that sequence. You can pick any one of those three. And the rules for each of these different lanes are different, and the bottom line difference from the legacy is that from the legacy system, meaning the older system, is that these lanes make more work for the veteran and makes it easier for the VA essentially to deny the claim. It shifts more work to the veteran. Then let's take the supplemental claim lane, for instance. Now, the VA sells this new program, as they sold it to Congress, that it should be faster than the old system. But faster doesn't necessarily mean better. It could mean that you just get your denial faster than under the old system. But under the supplemental lane, claim lane approach, a veteran has to submit new and relevant evidence in order to have that lane useful. In other words, they have to have something that can convince the VA that's new evidence and it's relevant to support the claim that had already been denied. The VA will assist to some extent in gathering and obtaining records, but it's essentially what we would call under the old system, where you're kind of in the same hamster wheel, you know, where you're throwing new evidence at the VA, hoping it'll be enough, but with the VA never being sure. Now, the higher level review lane, the closest similarity that we have to the old system was the decision review officer. But this higher level review lane is much more favorable to the VA in denying it and much less favorable to the veteran. It includes a review by a more experienced claim adjudicator based only on the evidence that was already considered. In other words, the veteran cannot submit any new evidence to support the claim. The VA has no duty to assist in gathering new evidence. However, the VA says that if the higher level reviewer discovers an error in the VA's duty to assist, they will return the decision to correct the error. But you see there's a lot of latitude there on the part of the higher level.
If I may on that one, too.
Jump in.
On that higher review, now in years past under the system, I'm going to use PTSD as an example. If a decision review officer has a case on appeal and he sees, you know, that he's analyzing the PTSD claim, and maybe the veteran was either denied, or maybe let's say he got a 30% rating, the decision review officer looking at the case now could actually say, well, you know, I think he was wrong, and I'm going to grant an increase to 70%. And he could do that. In the higher review, he could not do that. And that's one of the things a veteran needs to know. And if there's any veteran service officers and DAVs listening or lawyers listening, they can't do that. They can't substitute their interpretation of the evidence when they're making that higher review. Back to you, David.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. But one other limiting factor of the high-level review lane is that the veteran is not entitled to an in-person hearing, as was the case under the old system. Instead, the most you could get would be, as the VA describes it, a one-time informal telephone conference with the higher-level reviewer. And that's either between the veteran, if the veteran is not represented, or the veteran's representative, if there is a representative, and the higher-level reviewer. And that's basically to discuss the case, discuss what errors there might be in the case. But it does not give the right to present new evidence as you could in a hearing or new testimony. And the VA has said that choosing the optional one-time informal telephone conference may cause a delay in the processing of the higher-level review. And you might say, well, what does that mean? Well, under both the supplemental claim lane and the higher-level review lane, the VA has said that their goal is to have these decisions within 125 days, at least average, which is a much faster standard than under the old system. But now, let's go to the third option, which is the appeal to the Board of Veterans' Appeals. There you have three choices. You can either submit what's called a direct review, where the veteran does not want to submit any additional evidence. In other words, they just want the board, and you can't have a hearing under the direct review option. You're asking the board essentially to review the record as it already exists. Now, another board option is what's called evidence submission option, where the veteran can choose to submit additional evidence but without a hearing, and the veteran will have 90 days after the notice of disagreement to submit any additional evidence. And then the third option under the appeal to the board lane is the hearing option, where the veteran can choose to submit additional evidence and have a hearing with a veteran's law judge. And that will be the slowest of those options because you have to wait for the judge to be available. And you can present testimony and documents at the hearing and also submit evidence within 90 days after the scheduled hearing, which is something that we've occasionally done under the old system. So those are the three quote-unquote lanes, review lanes, under the new system. And you might say, well, what happens if you're not happy with the board's decision? Well, if you're not happy with the board's decision, the VA says you can either resubmit as a supplemental claim, but that means that you have to have already developed some new and relevant information, or you can appeal within 120 days to the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. So, a lot of options. I know this may sound complicated to listeners, but the VA does have some flyers which summarize these with diagrams and discusses the various features and limitations of each that I've tried to summarize. And they've got new forms for each of these choices.
Yeah, I recently spoke at a luncheon out here, and there were a dozen veterans there who currently have claims. A couple were my clients, and others were not. And I went through everything that you just said, David, and then said very well, thank you. a couple of the guys got up and walked out. They threw the papers on the floor and said, this is just more BS. And clearly, the frustration was evident by the veterans. So, you know, I'm glad to hear they got pamphlets out there that help guide these veterans. But the bottom line is it is more complicated and more frustration for the veteran. And, you know, it just, you know, I can't help but say this, but when I hear these veterans, they say to me, this is just more of the same BS, and all they're trying to do is frustrate us. And as we say in our group, delay, deny, hope you die. And that's the game plan for the VA. And that is, by the time we get through all these different paths and everything else, we'll be dead, and the VA won't have to pay, and that's their game plan. And it's really sad to hear that when, you know, these were men and women who fought for their country in all sorts of battles, you know, going way back, and they're being treated like this toward the end of their lives. It's just, it's insane. And so when I had these men and women in this luncheon, and I tried to, you know, I tried to play the VA card for them. I tried to give them some hope in here. And I got to tell you, they were so upset. And one of them was a veteran service officer, and he just threw up his hands. So you know, I guess we're going to wait and see what happens down the road, but. As this one veteran said to me, the only one who's going to win here is the VA, and that is they're not going to pay. So we just got to keep doing what we're doing, David, is try to keep helping these veterans so that they can see that there's light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to their compensation.
Well, I think ultimately, of those three lanes, the lane where a veteran is most likely going to receive the most thorough and accurate analysis is by the Board of Veterans Appeals judge. Unfortunately, that's going to be by far the slowest lane. And within that lane, the board lane, there's three choices, as I mentioned: direct review, evidence submission, and a hearing. And it's only the third of those, the hearing, where you get a hearing and you can, you know, sit across the table from the judge, or if you're doing a video conference, you know, you're watching the judge on a screen live and the judge is watching you, but where you can submit testimony and new evidence, I think then, unfortunately, that's going to be the slowest of the option, but most likely the option to give the fairest result, just from my experience. But in any event, I think the other two lanes shifts the burden more to the VA, makes it easier for the VA to deny it, which is not a surprise. That's something that you and I talked about on this show on many of our shows leading up to this legislation being passed. The legislation's biggest proponent was the VA itself, which I think was trying to make its work easier. And it's very ironic, as you say, Richard, that you know, the St. Pete office hired all these people, and they don't have enough of the new system cases yet, and yet, you know, where were all these people whenever we were waiting 3 or 4 years under the old system for the initial decision review officer hearing? Where was the VA then?
That's a great point.
You know, they got the people now who's sitting around twiddling their thumbs, and they ought to be going back and looking at these other cases and pulling them back from other regional offices where they may be sitting, like you say, where they've been brokered out to distribute, and now St. Pete has people that are not busy enough. But anyway, it's a management issue. It's a resource management issue, and the VA's
The problem there, David, is that for the most part, they don't know what cases have been brokered out. When I say they, the individual decision review officers don't know. And I'm just using myself as an example because that's all I can, you know, really rely upon. Unless I call or email one or two of these decision review officers that I have some communication with and bring up a case, and I sometimes just go through my files and say, I wonder what's going on with this file. And I shoot out an email to him. I say, can you give me an update or a status on this veteran's file? And he turns around and says, oh, my Lord, this one's in Boise. Let me see if I can get this back and you and I can work it up. But you see the process there. I went into my filing cabinet, pulled out a file that I've been sitting on for 6 or 9 months, had the wherewithal to get in touch with the decision review officer, who then checks on the status, sees that it's not even in St. Pete, that it's in Boise, and then he has the good heart to try to bring that case back to St. Pete so we can then work on it. That's a tough process. You're asking veterans to be able to have the right team in place, meaning the right representative helping them along, who has the right contact so that they can then initiate some contact down there about their case. I mean, you know, it's just, like I said, it's insane.
Well, the other thing is, despite all these rules and nice procedures, there's still the human factor. And we know from our own experience that you could have the very same case, the very same evidence, but before two different decision review officers, and one could really view his or her job as being there to assist the veteran, and the other one, whether they will consciously acknowledge it or not, they seem to throw up every obstacle they can in denying the case or lowballing the rating. We've had, and unfortunately, what we've seen over the last number of years is that most of the decision review officers we've encountered were of the second category, which is most of them were just as if they were looking for reasons just to deny it and force you to continue appealing it and wait 3 or 4 or 5 years for a hearing with the BVA, with the Board of Veterans Appeals. So it's really unfortunate. I think if they had proper management over there, all the people now that were hired that are not really busy enough, because they're waiting for the new cases, that they ought to pull back those cases that you said, Richard, have been brokered out to other regional offices and that are just sitting out there. Because some of those regional offices like Oakland, for instance, they have horrible reputations. They're worse than St. Petersburg. And, you know, the people in the VA know that, but they're not going to share that. You know, we find that out by luck, basically, from comments that are made to us or things that we pick up here or there. But the VA certainly doesn't publicize that. Yeah. So, in any event, there's a lot to that. It's a big issue that's affecting all veterans. We're down to our last few minutes, Richard. So why don't we move on towards any last news and comments you wanted to mention? Then we'll go to a closing.
No, we got some medical news from the VA. The VA announced on March 18th that it is on track to eliminate the hepatitis C virus in as few as 2 months, in all veterans willing and able to be treated. As of March 3rd, nearly 116,000 veterans started all oral hepatitis C medications in VA, of which 96,654 veterans completed treatment and have been cured. That's amazing. As the largest single provider of HCV care in the U.S., this is terrific news because it means we are within striking range of eliminating hepatitis C among veterans under the care of the Veterans Health Administration, said VA Secretary Robert Wilkie. Diagnosing, treating, and curing hepatitis C virus infection among veterans has been a significant priority for the VA. HCV infection can lead to advanced liver disease, liver cancer, and death. Treatment of HCV can prevent development of progression of ALV, greatly improving survival. However, before 2014, HCV treatment required weekly interferon injections for up to a year with low cure rates, 35% to 55%. Among veterans, it's significant physical and psychiatric side effects leading to frequent early discontinuation. Up to that time, of the approximately 180,000 veterans in VA care who had been diagnosed with chronic HCV infection, only 12,000 had been treated and cured, while over 30,000 had developed ALD. In early 2014, highly effective, less toxic, all-oral, direct-acting antivirals became available, revolutionizing the treatment of HCV. With the support of Congress and other stakeholders, VA implemented an aggressive program to find all undiagnosed veterans in VA care with HCV, including those who did not know they carried the infection, link to HCV care, and offer them treatment with these new medications. At the peak of this effort to rapidly deploy all oral direct-acting antivirals, VA began treating close to 2,000 veterans with HCV every week. Nearly one treatment started every minute of every workday. As a result of this historic effort, the overall death rate 1 year after treatment reduced to 80% among veterans in VA care with HCV. Veterans cured of HCV with these medications were also 84% less likely to develop liver cancer. The announcement cements VA's position as a national leader in diagnosis and treatment of HCV and marks a major milestone in the nation's fight against viral hepatitis. VA is on track to treat more than 125,000 veterans with these life-saving medications by October. Currently, fewer than 27,000 veterans in VA care remain to be treated. All marketed hepatitis C medications are on the VA National Formulary. Hepatitis C medications used today have few side effects and can be administered as a once-a-day treatment for as little as 8 weeks. For more information, go to www.hepatitis.va.gov/. And before we close the show tonight, we'd like to provide with our weekly reminder to veterans and their families about an important VA program called Coaching into Care. It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call, toll-free at 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, the VA's Coaching into Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I would like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has the Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
We'd like to thank you all for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. We'd like to thank our sponsors, Joyce and Joe Chivaroli and Corey and Hurley Law Group, and like to thank our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. Please tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.